Labour are just anti-fun.
They don't want people to be drinking. They don't want people to be talking to each other, mixing, because, my God, we might have germs.
Decent taxes bring in a decent bit of money, because turns out when the state tells you not to do something, sometimes you want to do it a little bit more.
Massive escalation of mental health disability that people are on. I think it's time to re-stigmatise mental health issues, to be honest. I've been saying this for some time.
It's a real sign of decline, isn't it? The queuing in pubs. You get one person at the bar, and then an American tourist will stand behind, and then the British will go, oh, that's a queue, I better join it. And then, and then that's it. Hello, listeners! Please welcome your hosts of the Last Orders podcast, Tom Slater and Chris Snowden. Yay!
Thank you very much, Chris, for that uncleared plan for the introduction. My name's Tom Slater. I'm the host of the Last Orders podcast. Thank you so much for coming. There's so many sessions on today in this time slot, so we're really glad that you joined us. As we've already heard from my co-host, Christopher Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, thanks, Tom. Very well indeed.
Very well, brilliant.
Very excited to be here in swinging London.
We're also delighted to be joined by not one, not two, but three brilliant guests for this live podcast. We've got Simon Evans, stand-up comedian and Spike columnist. How are you doing, Simon?
Hello, 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 thank you. Very kind of you. I'm tremendously well, thank you very much. I've done a little warm-up in a previous session and I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Brilliant, that's what we want to hear. And we also have Julia Hartley Brewer, talk presenter and Sun columnist. How are you doing, Julia? Yay!
Chris, I'm actually not horrified by being in London. This is your most hated place in the world, isn't it?
No, there's one or two other places.
And we're also very much delighted to be joined by Kate Andrews, The Spectator's economics editor and The Telegraph business columnist. Very good, Kate. So we have got lots to cover. We're going to talk about the rise of the fat jabs, Ozempic, et al., and what that means for the nanny state. We're going to talk a bit about the war on pubs that Labour seems intent on waging, as well as what might be in the budget in terms of sin taxes and the nanny state. But Chris, should we start off on Ozempic, Mounjaro, the various other weight loss jabs that have come to market recently? This has been in the news because Wes Streeting has signed a deal to trial weight loss jabs on the NHS to try and get obese people back to work. There's also been some indications that Ozempic in particular, I think, is bringing down obesity in the US. You wrote a piece for us this week basically saying that Ozempic has unmasked the whole grift of the nanny state by doing what all those nanny state policies couldn't do in terms of
actually reducing obesity.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about why you think that's good?
Yeah, I mean, I said Ozempic and other, you know, weight loss drugs are available, but Ozempic and its competitors have done more to reduce obesity in America than all the nanny state policies combined, which is not hard to do because the nanny state policies combined haven't done anything whatsoever. And it's probably early days to say, you know, we got this, you know, we got this, lads, because it's still 40% obesity in America. But it seems to have ticked down by a couple of percentage points, and it doesn't seem to be a coincidence. At the same time, you've got like 1 in 8 Americans have been on these drugs at some point, quite a lot. So Wes Streeting has said he wants to basically do a trial. So he's spending, I think, £220 million on a whole batch of the King Kong of weight loss drugs, which I can't remember, it begins with a T. But this apparently is even better than the Ozempic. So you're looking at like 20% weight loss on average rather than 15%. And it's a little bit cheaper. You can get it for £129 retail. So probably with a hard NHS negotiation, you can get it at about £150. And so he's going to dish this out to people who are A, obese, and B, unemployed, because he's bought into this whole bollocks about how the massive increase in the number of long-term sick in the last few years has nothing to do with the Tories messing up the benefits system,
about the
which
biscuits.
Is the actual reason. It's all about, it's all about obesity. And I'm not sure there's actually that many people who are so obese they literally cannot work. There's probably some. And if Wes Streeting can find these people and give them the jabs, and they actually do want to go back to work, which again is not necessarily the case, then I'm all in favor of trying it out. Partly because I think the government will at some point have to admit that obesity doesn't actually cost the NHS as much money as they thought it did, right? So the figures that are bandied around for costs to the NHS, the 5 million, 6 billion, 5 billion, 6 billion, 11 billion. I've heard people say the wider costs are £57 million, £100 million. Somebody said £198 million the other day. Now, if obesity, let's say, costs £57 billion a year, then it's actually very, very cost effective to give literally every single person with obesity these drugs for life. But that is actually a very big cost. I think it would cost something like £7 or £8 billion per year to actually do that. And I think once economists and the government start looking at this as a serious proposition, they will go, actually, I don't think it does make sense spending billions and billions of pounds giving people weight loss drugs. So maybe they'll have to admit that actually these cost estimates are hugely inflated. So that's the only reason I'm in favour of doing a trial. But as long as it's a trial and it's rigorously evaluated, we shall see. I know Julie is more sceptical than I am about whether these drugs actually do stop people being obese. I have to say, I've noticed a lot of good news stories of people who are kind of a little bit chubby becoming skinny. I haven't seen that many people who are morbidly obese becoming slim, you know? So let's just see what happens.
And Julia, you wrote in your Sun column this week, taking a very different stance there, Chris, not just on the question of should it be on the NHS, but the jabs in general. Do you want to say a bit more about
that? I know this is crazy, looking at evidence for a jab, but we talked to Professor Carl Hennigan, Professor of Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University, who's been pretty bloody good on this sort of thing over the last few years, I'm sure you'll agree. And as you look at the trials carried out by the drug companies themselves, 70% of people who take these drugs do lose weight. They lose on average 10% of their weight. If you take someone who's properly obese, 20 stone, they've lost 2 stone over a year. That's 0.5 pound a week. But you could just give up a latte and one slice of pizza and you could lose 0.5 pound in a week. That's insane. And also within 2 or 3 years, you're only allowed to be on the drug for 2 years. That's all it's safely licensed for, we're told. And after that, they put the weight back on, because they don't change their lives. I don't think this is a miracle drug. I don't think this is a wonder drug. I simply also do not trust that pharmaceutical companies are carrying out trials where absolutely they're 100% sure there are no, I mean, we know there are some dodgy side effects, you know, diarrhea and things like that, but there aren't some other long-term side effects. People are talking about giving these drugs to children. I mean, the only thing a fat child is suffering from is bad parenting. I find it absurd that we think this is a solution, particularly for someone who's unemployed and obese. The solution there is you're not entitled to benefits if you've willingly made yourself unable to work. That seems to me to be very basic. But also, I just think there's so many aspects of the reason why, you know, obesity is bad for you is not just because of the obvious instant physical implications of that. There's also this mental aspect. You know, you're probably depressed, whether it's depression before the weight or weight before depression. Lack of activity, lack of socialising, lack of other things. It's indicative of a whole other raft of problems. And I don't think giving someone a jab is a solution. And I definitely don't think it's a solution when it's paid for by taxpayers who are going out to work and who are struggling. And while there is still one kid not getting cancer treatment because it's too expensive and NICE won't approve it, there's one person, by the way, there's 24,000 a year, arriving at A&E and not getting treated quick enough for a heart attack or something and therefore dying. If one person, you know, like me, you know, haven't got a clue what my GP looks like because I can't remember the last time I saw her, then we do not have spare money for this. And can we spend our scarce NHS resources, 180 billion quid's worth, on stuff that actually we know works?
And what do you think, Kate, in terms of, is this just an odd priority to have as much as anything else?
I'm in a tough position because I hate it when mom and dad fight.
Did feel a bit like that.
And I feel incredibly torn at the moment. I'm closer to Chris on this. I think it is a miracle jab for people who are morbidly obese, who have an addiction to food, which I think is a real thing, and who are not under any other circumstances going to lose weight. And I think it's so much less invasive than the other procedures that they would historically have to have gone through. And it's a much easier process. And I think that there's a lot of benefit in this. And hopefully, given this is the Last Orders podcast, our panel agrees that individuals should be able to make private decisions about their body. The real question here is whether or not the state should pay for it. And I agree with Chris that a trial would be interesting. Do I think that the 5.8 million people on some kind of out-of-work benefit right now are largely there because they are obese and can't work? No, I don't. Do I think that that is a result of pretty horrendous lockdown policy that shoved people out of work and did it for months on end and it was hard to get them back? Yes, I do. But even put aside the out of work stuff, there will be people whose lives are suffering because they are not comfortable and they're not healthy in the body that they're in. And this being an easy solution does not fundamentally upset me. I know for a lot of people it does, you know, especially if you are the kind of person who works really hard to stay in shape or who has lost weight, quite a lot of it naturally. Some people go, well, you can do it. And Julia makes an important point here. If your lifestyle doesn't change, you're going to gain the weight back. But what I think we also have to be honest about is that for people for whom the lifestyle isn't going to change, they do have this addiction, they might be on this drug indefinitely. I can't judge it. I can't say it doesn't bother me that there is now a jab in which it makes it easier to do this. I think that's a great thing. I love it when innovation and technology and the market brings us things to make our lives easier. I think that's a good thing. So I'm interested in the trial. Because if the trial shows really positive signs and the government can get bang for its buck, well, that would be a great indication. But there's no guarantee that's going to happen. So this question about state money, I think, is really up for debate. But in general, I think this is great for people who otherwise wouldn't be able to lose the weight. I want them to live the kind of life they want to lead. And I really don't mind if there's an easier way to do that now than there was 10 years ago.
Simon, any objections to any of that?
Yes, I'm just scrabbling around in the dirt to think of things that haven't been said yet. I've got a few observations, which I don't know if they knit together into a coherent worldview, but I will just say, I've known a number of comedians, colleagues of mine. I remember about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a new weight loss program. I remember a couple of them, I won't name names, but there were a couple of fairly well-known comedians who lost so much weight that they became literally unrecognizable. I would be in the dressing room with them for half an hour before, oh my God, it's you, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. And they were, you know, and it was, anyway, they felt, you know, tremendously happy about that having, and every single one of them has put all that weight back on now. There was a procedure which was fashionable in Brighton and Hove, where I live, where I knew a couple of school mums who had their stomach stapled or otherwise physically restricted, invasive surgery. They lost a lot of weight. And the one that I can remember that I saw most recently had kept it off, but that was obviously at the expense of actually literally having her stomach, you know, reduced in size. Every single other intervention which I've ever encountered has been briefly successful and then has tapered away. I am somebody who shares with Julia a certain amount of exasperation instinctively at people who can't control their own calorie input-output ratio in order to remain, you know, reasonably functional. But there is something weird going on. If you look at the map of America of obesity and try and work out what it correlates with, it doesn't seem to correlate with the thing. They've tried so many interventions, and it's so serious in America. I remember going on a holiday in Florida about 10 years ago, Disney World. It was genuinely scary. It was like that scene in Wall-E, you know, where these people are just floating around in sort of high-tech obesicles. I made a whole routine about it, you know. But you would go into shops and see clothing. You had to sort of measure the number of X's before the L. You couldn't count them. They were beyond... It was absolutely horrific. And the thing it most closely correlates with, it seems, is altitude, like your proximity to the water table. It seems like it might be something to do with estrogens or something. God knows what it could be, but it's not easily solved. Mm-hmm. I totally understand why we're treating. I am not like a puritanical about this. If there is a drug which stops people from not being able to master their own appetite, then... You know, that's a downward trajectory. I deplore it in a way. I regret it. You know, this is not like the polio vaccine. This is not like antibiotics. This is essentially ceding a part of what it is to be human to a chemical re-engineering. But, you know, if it were to prove to work and to survive the initial, but it's always that Pepsi challenge thing. I don't know if you're familiar with the Pepsi challenge, but basically the Pepsi challenge proved to Coca-Cola that people preferred the taste of Pepsi in shopping malls, and they panicked and they brought out new Coke, which tasted like Pepsi. And then they realized that actually by the third or fourth gulp, people prefer Coke. But it's just the newness of the Pepsi taste that people, and so they had to bring back out classic Coke. There's always like a little honeymoon period with these things, but the human brain is remarkable in its resistance to tampering. It will find a workaround and it will get fat again.
There we go. Chris, do you want to deal with any of those challenges, objections there to your very pro-Ozempic line?
Well, I mean, I'm not that pro-Ozempic. I want them to do this trial so they realise that obesity is not actually costing the government that much money.
But also that it's not the government's business.
And all, people want. I mean, it's just not the government's business.
Yeah, well, once the government realises it's not actually costing it any money, then maybe it will realise it's money.
I don't think they will. I think they'll still be wagging finger.
Well, they're still going to. He's made it clear he's going to do the finger wagging stuff, regardless. All I would say is, to your point, Julia, that this is not going to stop people being obese. The 10 or 15% weight loss is an average, and some people don't lose any weight at all. And given that it does suppress your appetite pretty much permanently when you're while you're on it, it's not hard to see how somebody, you know, could be incredibly morbidly obese and over a period of years could end up being...
But you're only supposed to be on it for 2 years. Blah. There's a fatal flaw there, isn't there?
They say that about Nicorette patches and stuff. Just do it anyway.
Marriage, all but, sorts of things. But,
the facts... I don't know. the fact that, you know, you can't get around the fact that obesity has declined in America. So that would suggest that...
Isn't that more likely to be to do with the economy and people...
The economy? Just,
yes. People are poorer. People then have less money to spend on food.
The poorer you get, the fatter you get. That's the genius of the current system.
Sorry, Kate, you want to say something? Well, I think the nicotine patch is a good thought experiment. So when we think about addictions, you know, if there were a jab or a magic pill that you could take so that you stop drinking when you have a drinking problem, or that you didn't react to alcohol the way that you might do if you're an alcoholic, or if there are these patches, but perhaps far more successful ones that could help somebody stop smoking if they wanted to, if a jab could help you stop smoking, I don't think we would have the same kind of resistance to it. And I think Simon makes a good point there about sort of the humanness of all of this, that everybody struggles with temptation. Mm-hmm. And some people struggle with it a lot more than others. And so I think the question really is, well, A, should the state be involved? But B, what is your threshold for thinking I'm going to have sympathy towards that particular issue, that particular human issue? If we don't struggle with something as individuals, it can be quite hard to empathize. But I think the signs in America are so encouraging. This jab clearly is working, and if it gets people to living a healthier life, do we really care how they got there in the end?
There's plenty more we could say about this, and we'll probably return to it when we come up for questions as well. But in the spirit of trying to move through the topics, Simon, I wanted to come to you about something that you've written about over the course of the past week, which will be our next topic, which is Labour's war on the pub. We've already been talking about on the show, and many of us have been railing against the fact that since Labour came into government, they've had this kind of preoccupation with making pubs as unprofitable and as miserable as possible. They have already firmed up plans to ban smoking in beer gardens. There's been ideas floated of minimum pricing potentially, or shorter licensing hours, all kinds of things. But there's really been an escalation in this war because of some plans which have been reported on by the Telegraph as part of a new employment rights bill, basically requiring landlords to police offensive comments within their own establishments. The idea being that it could amount to a form of harassment for the members of staff. You wrote about this for us, because I say, do you want to tell us a bit more about this and what you think of it?
Yeah, I think it's the it's a sort of mission drift. Is that the expression? You know, the
mission creep.
Yeah, exactly. Where a certain kind of mindset, which has been well established in human resources departments in large corporations for a number of years, is starting to enter much smaller business establishments where it really has no place and just can't function. To bring it into a pub where there's a work environment where the whole point is people are coming down, having a drink and letting their hair down, is obviously going to have a chilling effect, is that term that we use again and again. It's the kind of soft power of, and it may well be unintended consequences, but there is a point at which when it mounts, the accumulated sequence of hostile actions taken towards this venerable British institution begins to make you wonder whether they don't really have some fundamental issue with the idea that people get together sometimes in the evening, have a drink, let their hair down and speak their mind. They don't seem to like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously it wasn't, I can't remember exactly when the anti-smoking legislation came in. That was the first, 2007. Okay, so that was like the dying gasp of the Blair government then, yeah. I always thought it was quite kind of ironic or funny that Roy Castle, who used to host Record Breakers, his death did actually probably create the one record for which he'll always be fundamentally remembered, which is that he triggered that. I had a friend who worked for
I think it's called Forest, wasn't it? The organisation.
Freedom organisation, the right to enjoy smoking tobacco.
That's right. And a friend of mine who worked there said that it was Roy Castle's death that had been the death knell for smoking in pubs. But anyway, the point is there's just been a repeated, obviously some of these things are not anyone's fault. There are demographic changes. A large parts of the Northwest, you know, where there used to be a pub on every corner. Well, maybe, I don't know, 20-30% of the population in some places now might not drink alcohol as part of their faith. You know, that's obviously having an impact as well. There's all kinds of elements. There's almost nothing in support of it. And yet pubs form a very, very important part of our social infrastructure. Most of us remember fondly, you know, getting into pubs a couple of years before you were supposed to and being allowed to sort of jostle, you know, and fight for elbow room at the bar among the older. Seeing people not of your generation handle drink and get into conversations maybe with them. This is important. You don't just want kids sitting at home drinking cans in front of the telly or double screaming. You want them to be knitted into the community when they're learning how to drink, and also, you know, falling fertility rates. But anyway, there's another conversation.
Exactly. The kids these days are not drinking. Teenage pregnancy is falling through the floor.
Well, as somebody said, I can't remember who it was said recently, but a serious commentator said that you know, when you look back through human history, the vast majority of people born were not planned for. And there is some truth to that, you know. You need to have some alcohol for people to make unwise choices.
that's a pro-natalist argument.
My old joke goes, most people are in fact like Marmite, a byproduct of the brewing industry.
Julia, what have you made of, not just necessarily this policy, but the preoccupation with the pub that the Labour government seems to have?
Labour are just anti-fun. I mean, they're just anti, they don't like people enjoying themselves. It's just wrong. Everyone should be at a seminar rather than actually having fun and talking freely, exchanging ideas with people, which I think is a crucial aspect of the pub experience. I say this as someone who spent many years working as a barmaid. And I'll tell you what, if you want to have unpleasant behaviour or words policed, landlords are pretty darn good at it. Yeah. They really don't take any nonsense. They know their licence is at stake and they look after it. And I've just never seen this as an issue. What they're talking about is people expressing their own views, which they can't express at work, God forbid, anymore, and being allowed to speak freely and exchanging ideas. So of course they don't like it. That's against everything they believe in. They don't want people to be drinking. They don't want people to be talking to each other, mixing, because my God, we might have germs. I mean, I just think this is so fundamental to where this Labour Party is, the Keir Starmer Labour Party is, more than Blair. I don't think Tony Blair ever enjoyed going to a pub. But I think they accepted that people did. And this is a classic example of how Labour right now are massively out of touch with ordinary people and how ordinary people live their lives.
Yeah. Chris, there's a lot of the policies that you've railed against over the years, whether it's the smoking ban or various other things, have brought the pub trade to its knees time and time again. But do you think there's a genuine chance that this government could be the one to really, not finish it off, of course, but kind of reduce it by a significant margin? Are the pressures just going to become too much with the kind of policies that we're talking about?
Well, if they ban banter, yeah, I think that would probably
be a bit of a
hammer blow. It's hard to know what the Labour actually want to do with this, or most things, actually. You know, they keep sort of flying kites of things, and then people say, no, you're kidding, and you never hear about it again. So there was something mentioned at the Labour conference by the Public Health Minister about we want to have a look at licensing laws. And then the Department of Health immediately came straight out and said, we are definitely not going to be reducing pub opening hours. Then there was a thing about the banning smoking outdoors, which would be, I mean, that would just close thousands and thousands of pubs straight away, and bingo halls and casinos and every nightclub pretty much in the country. But that was kind of leaked by The Sun. And then the government came straight out and said, yeah, we are looking at doing that. But then I haven't heard anything about it since. Look, if they ban banter and they ban smoking outdoors, that's it. That's game over for the pub trade. And I think then the Simon's conspiracy theory that all politicians secretly want to close down pubs will have been proven. So it's not, they're in a death spiral. That's the trouble with the pubs. I paid £7.55 for a pint of lager the other day at the Marcus of Granby. And It's becoming genuinely painful to buy a round of drinks now for more than like two or three people. And if somebody orders a gin and tonic, I visibly kind of...
you physically eject them.
Yeah.
Chris, I have a teenage daughter and she can tell you the whole of North London where all the cheapest pints are available.
She's got a weather spoons can still do it. This spoons, is the thing, right? Yeah. So these pubs I'm talking about in Westminster, they are very well attended. All right, they're probably not so well attended at the weekends and maybe part of the afternoon. But, you know, gone, you know, 5 o'clock, people are spilling out onto the pavement. They're drinking pint after pint after pint. Why can they not bring down the price of a pint a bit when Tim Martin, in London, in Spoons, you can still get £1.99 pints of Ruddles and stuff. Wetherspoons is currently doing a 6% beer for £1.99. So cheap that in Scotland it would have to be more expensive than that because of minimum pricing. He can do it. Mm. Why are all the other pubs not just a bit more expensive, but like three times as expensive? So as much as I sympathise with the pubs, I do think there might be an element of profiteering from some of them, which I guess, I don't know, could be solved by more competition. I'm not sure. Westminster Council probably don't allow many new pub licences to get through. So I don't know. They're in a death spiral because fewer people are going. This really started with the smoking ban, let's face it. Fewer people went, particularly in the daytime. Your daytime old man, you know, smoking a rollie, they stopped going. A lot of pubs stopped even opening in the daytime, you know, to try and cut costs. But of course, that means you've got fewer customers in, and you've got fewer customers, so you have to put the price of a pint up, and the price of the pint being too expensive means that people don't go, and so it goes on, you know. And that's how they end up closing, just this spiral of decline.
And Kate, these sorts of nanny state policies, they often seem like the kind of last refuge of the quite visionless politician. When Rishi Sunak didn't really know what he was for, he decided that he was going to come out and ban smoking entirely. Even the smoking ban in the Blair years was kind of, I need a legacy that isn't Iraq. Why is this Labour government doing this stuff first? Why are they so preoccupied with these lifestyle issues, do you think? Do you think they're just... they've just really convinced themselves of this kind of preventative health ideology, I guess.
Well, it's a bad sign, isn't it? It was the dying days of a Tory government that decided to bring in a generational smoking ban. And it seems to be some of the first decisions of a Labour government with a huge majority to go down the nanny state track. And I think it is a sign of a government that has perhaps come in with perhaps more vague ideas than actual plans for policy and reform. Nanny state policies tend to be the, oh, we must do something. We must show the public we're doing something, so we'll ban things, rather than actually build some homes, actually reform the NHS, things that perhaps might have a little more weight attached to them. But they can do real harm in the process. And, you know, I think one of the big questions here is, has a member of the cabinet been to a pub? Keir Starmer had Beergate and Angela Rayner was clubbing in Ibiza, so they're familiar with the concept of fun. We know that they can have a bit of fun and that's great for them, but have they actually stepped into a pub or indeed to a Christmas party? Another policy that's been speculated about is that there could be a crackdown on the office Christmas party for very similar reasons, because they're sexist, racist environments where dangerous things happen. And you just have to wonder, have you really attended many of these? I'm not pretending that life is a fairy tale and that after hours, after alcohol has been consumed, that bad things can't happen. They can. But I bet most people here have been to a pub. I'm a foreigner and I've been to the pub more times than I can count. And when you walk in, you don't suddenly feel unsafe. You don't suddenly think that terrible sexist things are going to happen to you. You don't sit around and watch everybody wondering what's going to come out of their mouth. You have a nice time. You have a good time at your office Christmas party. You have a good time down at the pub. People look forward to this experience. And I think there's some doom-mongering here. This idea that these are places that need more policing, that need the thought police even to come in because they're so dangerous, it's absolute nonsense. And maybe they need to go to the pub a bit more and realize that actually it's an okay place to be.
Yeah. I've got to say, I slightly disagree as far as I feel like when you walk into an establishment, fear for your life, you know it's a good place. You can have some fun there. We're fast running out of time, Chris, but I want to talk a bit about what might be coming up in the budget, because I know that you've written a piece for The Spectator talking about the various kites that are being flown by various public health and nanny state groups trying to get Rachel Reeves to clamp down on their particular vice of choice. Do you want to tell us about what you think might be in store for us at the end of the month?
Who knows what's actually in store? But I mean, it's been interesting to see how many single issue pressure groups is lobbying for Rachel Reeves to loot the people they don't like, the industries they don't like in particular. So you had Greenpeace want to have a tax on frequent flyers of 100 euros per flight. And they said this is going to bring in 60 billion pounds across Europe or something like that. And the anti-smoking people want to have a levy on the tobacco industry, which is going to bring in supposedly 3 billion pounds. The anti-gambling people want to have a, they don't want to double betting taxes, which supposedly bring in 3 billion pounds. The anti-alcohol people up in Scotland want to have a tax on the supermarkets for selling alcohol because they think they're making more money out of alcohol because of minimum pricing, which is a policy they'd lobbied for in the first place, and it's just gone up to 65p because they've been lobbying for it, and the supermarkets probably aren't actually making any more money from it anyway. So everybody's just trying to get money from people they don't like, who they think have got plenty, to spend themselves, right? It's just a grift. It's an out-and-out grift. You know, they say that every cause starts as a movement, turns into a business, and degenerates into a racket. That's absolutely true if you look at the anti-tobacco and anti-gambling people in particular. The anti-gambling people are just so blatant about it. It's unbelievable. You know, so a couple of years ago, the government said, we're going to have a levy on the gambling industry. It's going to bring in 50 million pounds. Straight away, every public person was out of their traps going, 50 million pounds, 50 million pounds. I'll have some of that action. And just started fishing around, trying to get it, you know. And the action on smoke and health, yeah, like tobacco isn't taxed enough already. Do you know what I mean? They go, oh, the tobacco industry is profiteering and we need to have a tax on their profits. And HMRC said, well, that's a weird way of doing it. It's just a really round the houses way of getting more money from smokers. Because if you tax the tobacco industry, let's put the price of cigarettes up. And we can put the price of cigarettes up ourselves with excise duty. So we'll just do that. So then the anti-smoking people came back and said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to cap the price of cigarettes so the tobacco industry can't put the price of cigarettes up and then scoop off this extra profit. It's like, hang on, I thought you wanted higher cigarette prices. That's the whole, your whole thing is getting the price of cigarettes up so people don't start smoking. But it just shows what a grift it is, that they're now conspiring to cap the price of cigarettes just so they can rob money off the tobacco industry. And by the way, every pack of cigarettes sold, the tobacco industry makes £1 and the government makes about £10. So who's actually profiteering from this particular behaviour? So everyone's basically fishing around for tax rises. Rachel Reeves is obviously looking for tax rises, so she may well go along with this stuff. She's getting £1 million, or had £1 million from Derek Webb, now one of the biggest Labour donors, who's behind all the anti-gambling groups in the country, pretty much. So we shall see what she does. But I would suspect that, yeah, alcohol, booze and gambling will all see pretty significant tax rises just because there's an apparently ever-increasing black hole, apart from anything else.
Simon, what do you make of all of this, insofar as it seems like through all of these different sin taxes, the government, they just take it as a matter of course that it's their responsibility to stop us not just from being unhealthy, but engaging in habits and hobbies that they tend to dislike. What, you know, is the strangeness of this lost on people a little bit? Have we got too used to the government basically dictating how we should live our lives, even in the minutiae in that sense?
I mean, there's a sort of double think involved, isn't there? Or a moral complexity in terms of saying, yes, if you want to tax gambling, is that social engineering? You're trying to discourage it, and at the same time going, well, there's a load of cash we can get off that. That is obviously, you know, not a morally supportable point of view. You know, it's not philosophically coherent. And it doesn't seem to work. And I think there is a kind of rainbow vision of if you could only get people out of the betting shops on a Thursday, rainy Thursday afternoon, they go off and study, you know, Nietzsche or Aristotle or something. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. These are, in the same way that if we can only help people lose weight, they'll get back to work. You know, there's already, it's expensive, it is stigmatized, it's incredibly low status to find yourself spending your afternoon in an arcade or a betting shop. I just don't think it's going to have the effect that they want to. And as Chris has written up at length in that article, the idea that you can cream it off the gross rather than off the net and these places will survive is deluded. I suppose I think there is enough of a tradition now of yes, very high duty on tobacco that people have accepted that we are probably trying in the long term to squeeze tobacco out of public life altogether. And of course, at that point, this is the point at which it becomes a grift, because they need to be able to get the revenue from that at the same time as wanting it to be stopped. They cannot square that circle entirely. And so it is infuriating.
Obviously, I think the best kind of taxation is on is the kind that minimises the impact it has on innovation, on hard work, on entrepreneurship, and that kind of thing. And to this extent, I suppose if all you're doing is taxing, arguably, you know, marginalised recreational pursuits and so on, that is better than taxing corporations or entrepreneurs or people who are working on their income tax and so on, or that is actually going to minimise the incentive
they
structure.
Well,
they are,
These taxes we're talking about, sorry to butt in, but these taxes we're talking about, they are not going to put the price of the product up, right? No. So the tobacco one, they're specifically capping it. The idea of taxing supermarkets or alcohol retailers is not to put the price up. The minimum pricing is put the price up, but it's not bringing any money in for the government.
Right.
So this is a way to get a bit more money for the government. And gambling, you can't put the price of gambling up because you choose how much you spend. So you walk into a casino, they can tax the casino, but you're still putting a fiver down on red regardless, right? So you can't really have a sin tax as such on gambling. All you can do is shaft the industry to the point where they just cut down on their staff and ultimately probably just stop operating at all.
Yeah. It's absolutely true, and it's all rather dismal. And but I think there is, as I say, I think the problem is that those people are very low status, smokers and gamblers in particular are very low status, and in the same way that it becomes difficult to stand up for people who get nearly 3 years in jail for a bad tweet, you know, there's a fear that the stink will attach to you if you stand up for them.
I should say, as soon as you said that smokers are low status, Chris gave me a very patronising sideways look.
He said gamblers as well.
No, that's true.
So between us, we are low status.
Exactly. Of course, sin taxes fall on people who have usually the least disposable income, right? They fall on the poorest in society because they tend to smoke, they tend to gamble. And it's hard not to feel like there's a bit of a class snub taking place there when they bring in more sin taxes. They do raise money because people tend not to change their behavior. This is the thing that the sin taxes are always brought out by a politician as, oh, we're trying to look after the vulnerable and the marginalized. We want to help them help themselves. They just take their money. The sugar tax has been raising hundreds of millions of pounds a year because people aren't consuming less sugar. They're just paying more for it. Mm. So you can't separate these sin taxes from who they really impact, and that is the poorest in society. And it's not doing anything to improve their health. It's boosting the treasury coffers, not by loads at the moment, but certainly in terms of smoking. This is something no politician will talk about. If you do phase out smoking altogether, and that can be it's a noble aim in my opinion, so long as every adult is consenting to it, because it's an adult decision to make. But to live in a smoke-free world where nobody wants to smoke, fantastic. It's £10 billion the government will have to find in terms of lost revenue. Nobody wants to talk about that, because actually, these sin taxes bring in a decent bit of money, because turns out when the state tells you not to do something, sometimes you want to do it a little bit more.
And Julie, before we go out for questions, I saw you recoil in horror at the mention of a frequent flyer levy.
Well, that really hit me. I've got to be honest with you. I could single-handedly keep the economy afloat with that. But this is the thing, isn't it? And this is where I have been on quite a journey. In large parts, thanks to Chris Snowden and this podcast, actually, reading what you've been writing over the years, I came from quite a nanny state sort of attitude, which is something I'm very anti-smoking. I loved the smoking ban in 2007, as an ex-barmaid especially, but also, you know, I don't like gambling. I find gambling very just distasteful. I think it's very unhealthy, especially the online gambling now. People aren't in the betting shops. They're doing it online. It's very addictive. But it's where Chris has helped change my mind on this. And I'm really pleased you have, because actually my thing was, well, I don't like these things. So I don't mind if they're banned or they're taxed or they're criticized. But what about my things? Well, you know, I do like, you know, unhealthy food, and I do like my booze. And I like my flying, and I like all these things. So when they come for those things and they get those things, and then they came for my things. And then I started worrying, and I realized, yeah, we need to stand up against all of it. Because again, like as you say, okay. And it's the same with things like Sadiq Khan's congestion charge. We're going to take, you know, all of the polluting vehicles out of London, and we're going to raise a load of money by taxing all the polluting vehicles coming into London. Well, which is it? You can't be both. Yeah. And it's the same thing. What I would much prefer is that people didn't have lives where they wanted to eat themselves to oblivion, to smoke 20 or 40 cancer sticks a day, and to gamble away, you know, remortgage the house and gambling away every penny they had. But that's about people having better, more interesting, productive, worthwhile, happy lives. And the government never seems to care about that. They always want the money, and they want to wag their fingers. So
Yeah, I've been on a journey on this one, and I'm now of the view that even if I don't like it, even if I don't do it, even if I don't approve of it, it doesn't mean it's something that anyone else should have any say in terms of stopping other people doing it.
My career has not been a complete waste of time. Yes. One person.
I salute you.
One convert. How many years, Chris, this is going on? Let's go out for questions. Do we have microphones? Yep, we've got one there and one there. So there's a gentleman in the middle here. Someone could get to him. And then where else? Yeah, just there. And then while he's talking, do you want to just pass the microphone to this gentleman up front as well, please? Thank you.
Great show, by the way. So as I'm sure Chris will discover, the smell of cannabis is all pervasive on the streets of London. Do the panel, would they legalise cannabis and should the government tax it?
Thank you. And down here, there was another question over here as well. Was someone? Sorry, go for it. Was there
one? Isn't this done because the government believes, or people in the government believe, it's popular?
It is.
Opinion polling on these things, they want to ban gambling, they want to make alcohol less, they want these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And secondly, is most of this indulging of moral panic actually because the government doesn't want to do the things it knows it has to do that are much, much harder?
Definitely. Yeah. We'll take a couple more over here. Yeah. And then, do you want to pass that to him afterwards? Thank you. Go for it.
Thank you. I've been an intensive care consultant for 30 odd years, and the irony is never lost on me that we have a population who will turn down a vaccine that's been tried and tested in evidence-based medicine and fight that, but are quite prepared to stick a needle in themselves to lose a bit of weight as well. And the irony is just not lost on me.
Thank you. And over here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ewan Grant. I'm a former interviewee of Julia and ex-customs and excise. The logistics of the smuggling gangs for cigarettes very much became the drugs logistics networks and now the people trafficking networks. There's a very strong link. My question is about the budget. When does taxing wealth become taxing savings?
Thank you very much. Right, I'm going to come back, but I will come back out shortly. So we've got a lot there. Would you legalise cannabis? Is this all a moral panic? The gentleman's point there about what people are prepared to stick in their bodies and what they're not for some reason. Chris, should we start off with cannabis?
Yeah.
And this whole question, something you've written a lot about over the years, of course.
You certainly do smell a lot in London, don't you? Yes. Yeah. I would legalise it, but you're only allowed to smoke it indoors with the windows closed. It might be the solution. And obviously get rid of the smoking ban so people can smoke it indoors. And indeed, opium as well. I would also legalise to smoke. Do you want me to do, we're just doing one question at a time?
No, take a couple.
This stuff is popular. It does seem to be, doesn't it? It does seem to be. I would say, firstly, that sometimes we don't want to have kind of mob rule. You know, John Stuart Mill's point was that, you know, people are quite easily swayed one direction or the other. It all largely depends on how you ask the question, and the question rarely mentions trade-offs. So take the outdoor smoking ban, which actually doesn't even seem to be that popular, but it's about 50-50 from what I can tell. Only 13% of the population smoke, so you know, most people haven't got a stake in this whatsoever. Non-smokers only use the outdoor area for about 3 months a year. They're not going to be using it for the next 8 months, probably. You know, so to a large extent, it's none of their business. But insofar as they approve it, yeah, people increasingly instinctively would just say yes to any sort of ban. I think, I suspect if you said, would you like to ban all advertising for anything, most people would say yes to it. You know? But again, it's about the trade-off. If you said, well, yeah, would you like to ban advertising for all these things, but your local sports team has half as much money and this and that, and you don't get a free newspaper and your price of your tube tickets go, well, yeah, people probably go, no. Same with the outdoor smoking ban. So, yeah, would you like to ban people smoking outdoors if it means the chance of your local closing down rises from 10% to 50%? I suspect people would go, actually, I don't really care about this. So support for this stuff is quite wide but very shallow. It is worrying that there seems to be a growing misanthropic large minority in the population. And maybe at some point we just need to divide the country into two, really, and just say, we cannot live together anymore.
Fun
you can have that bit, we'll have that bit, and we'll just secede.
Never let it be said. Yes. Never let it be said that we don't have solutions.
Yeah.
I'm so up for this.
Kate, is there anything you want to respond to, particularly the gentleman's
sure.
question there with the budget coming up?
Yeah, question about taxing wealth, taxing savings. So I think quite a few of the measures, we don't know what's in the budget, right? We haven't seen the budget. There's a lot of speculation, a lot of briefing going on. And it does seem that quite a few measures that the Chancellor was considering, particularly around pension relief, the feedback has been actually this is really going to hurt people in the public sector, and it's really going to hit people on wages, which are very good wages, but not what you would consider to be sky high wages. Make of what you will that that is the argument that has perhaps convinced them to scrap some of these ideas. But indeed, it does seem that some of those ideas have been scrapped. Rachel Reeves has a very tough decision to make here, because on the one hand, Labour are making positive noises about growth, and they seem to have clocked that given the fact that there isn't a lot of money to spend, that they need the private sector to invest in order to have all these new roads and homes and energy infrastructure that they want. And that's quite a good thing. But that's going to have to translate to incentives in her first budget. And if she does go after the savers, if she does go after the entrepreneurs and the investors, that is going to be a signal to business after this massive investment summit, where they, again, had a lot of positive noise from business, but they're going to want to see the details, and that could really end up putting them off. So that is what she's going to be juggling in the coming weeks. I would legalize cannabis, and I would regulate it, and I would tax it. And I think a lot of the positive signs we're seeing in America, the metric a lot of people use is, are more people consuming cannabis in some way now? And if you look at Colorado, if you look at California, the answer is yes. And they say, so this policy has failed. But look at what they're consuming. You know, the stuff that you get now that isn't regulated, that in many cases isn't safe, is 100 times more potent than what, you know, my parents' generation would have been trying in the 60s and 70s. The fact that people are able to access actually really high quality and pretty light stuff is fundamentally a good thing. And I say this as somebody who tried cannabis once when she was a teenager, had to call her dad to pick her up at 2 a.m. and thought she was going to die. So I'm not, you know, I don't get any personal benefit out of this. I'll never touch it again, but it strikes me as an obvious thing to do. And then the last thing I just want to say is about this point about it's popular to ban things. Yes, it does seem to be the case. I can't remember exactly what it is. I think 25% of the population would still like to have nightclubs close permanently post-pandemic. That's yeah. And there's another one. It's lower than 25%, but there's a percentage of the population that still thinks the Rule 6 should be applied. So if you ask the public what they think, they seem very authoritarian. However, to be a little bit optimistic here, I'm very into stated versus revealed preferences. It's very easy to fill out a questionnaire, speak to a pollster and say, yes, I'd like to ban the things I don't like. The old Julia of 2007, if you will.
But no, I still support that.
But look at how they voted in the last election. Reform got a huge percentage of the vote. In terms of where the polls are going now, as Labour goes down, the support isn't going to the Tories. It's going to Reform. What is Nigel Farage, if not the poster, for having a cigarette and smoking a pint outside of the pub? People like it. They relate to it. They like the idea of telling politicians and government, you know what, please leave me alone after hours. This is my time. I do what I want. Votes went in that direction. Now, there's a lot to unpack there. Immigration was a big factor. Reform, let's be honest, was promising some very unrealistic spending and some very unrealistic tax cuts. Wasn't properly scrutinized. There's a lot going on there. But if we really break it down, I think Nigel Farage has very successful. Criticize the man all you want, but he's very successfully become that poster child for, I'm going to have a drink, I'm going to have a cigarette, I'm going to do what I want, and people like it. So let's look at how they fill out the questionnaire, but let's also look at how they vote. And I do think a lot of Tories in particular were very frustrated at that nannying mentality that the Tory party adopted towards the end. And I think a lot of them that went to Reform were pretty sick and tired of that, along with some of the other policies. Mm-hmm.
Simon, any points to make, or indeed drug experiences?
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree with the very last thing Kate said there about that sense of the Tory party becoming dismally nanny state towards the end, and in particular Sunak's absurd plan for
elevating the age at which you can buy tobacco every year, so that you had this ridiculous scenario of like 50-year-olds hanging around outside the Yorf license hoping a 60-year-old would buy them some fags. It was obviously ludicrous. That's not even reductio ad absurdum. That's like, that's a second order effect. You don't even have to go very far down the chain. So absurd that even Jacinda Ardern threw it out. But I do think that, I suppose I'm a hypocrite here. I am a little bit concerned for, again, reasons that Kate said about the marijuana thing. On the one hand, and yes, I used to smoke at university, and to be honest with you, it is the single thing I regret most about my university years. It's a dismal drug. The first couple of times you take it, you have a real laugh, and then it just becomes habitual. It saps morale, it saps motivation, it saps the inclination to take advantage of all the extraordinary wealth of opportunities you have at that age to go out and join societies and just be adventurous and get up in the morning and embrace life, and instead you just sit there watching daytime TV, and there's far too much of that already in the country. So I would be a bit anxious about anything that encouraged people to slip down that, as it goes hand in hand with the massive escalation of mental health disability that people are on, you know, sickness, disabilities. I think it's time to re-stigmatise mental health issues, to be honest. I've been saying this for some time. But also, as Kate said, the potency. I remember, yeah, crumbling a bit of Red Leb into a king size Rizla. That's one thing. But some of this stuff, you feel a bit weird just walking past it in the street now. And I don't know. I feel a little bit uncertain about that. I prefer them to legalize and tax coke, to be honest. That at least makes you industrious. And apparently the purity is going up at the moment and the price is stable, which tells you something about the free market as well.
Julia, well, anything you want to?
Well, I'll tackle the cocaine issue. I've never, amazingly, never tried cocaine. Drugs have never appealed to me, but my husband's always had a plan that if we're ever down on our luck, we're going to have me try cocaine and we're going to do it on pay per view. Just how fast I can talk. thanks for that idea, babe. I'll tackle the cannabis issue. I am very, very opposed to cannabis being legalised. We have smoking, smoking literally, if you do it as described, advised by the industry that makes them, it will kill you. There's a very strong argument for it being phased out in a way that is as least nanny state as possible. I can understand that, although I disagree with the policy that Rishi Sunak wanted to bring in Keir Starmer planning. But we've had smoking in our society, in fact, in every society in the world since time immemorial, and we've had alcohol in every society. It's a big part of our social life and our interactions. Drugs haven't been, actually, historically, and there's loads of evidence that actually if drugs are legalised, more people will try them. One of the biggest reasons people don't do drugs is they believe that they are illegal, they don't want a criminal record, and they must be unsafe because they're illegal. But my main argument against cannabis legalisation is that cannabis makes people really, 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 really dull. And I think that's a really good argument against them.
We'll get you there, Julian. Another 10 years, Crystal.
Oh, yeah, he'll be around on this, yeah.
Chris, do you want to start that process now?
I'll be seeing it with my split.
That would be a hell of a podcast. Take a more sort of Roganish turn. But anyway, was there anything you want to say?
I'm not an advocate for cannabis at all. I totally agree with Simon about cannabis. If anything, I hope that maybe if it was legalised, people might go off it because of the lack of the forbidden fruit aspect. But I certainly don't encourage anyone to take bloody cannabis. And it does smell. And it's amazing how you can never tell where it's coming from. You just smell it in the street. And you assume it's someone right behind you or something. It's not. And you look around.
It is very worthwhile to say that there seems that for a while there was this moment where people were saying, oh, you know, it's actually better to smoke cannabis than a cigarette, almost talking down the dangers that can be associated with cannabis. And there certainly are many, especially when it comes to mental health. You do have to take that very seriously. It's why I bring up the issue of potency, because a lot of what people are consuming on the black market is really scary stuff. And that is fundamentally different to a gummy that you pick up in a regulated store that's going to have you a bit dizzy for 10 minutes and then it's going to wear off. I would, if you're going to do it, and none of us would advocate you do, I would much prefer a situation where you got to buy that legally and you knew what you were putting in your body.
And Simon, speaking to your conspiracy theory earlier, well, it's not really a conspiracy theory, but the fact that the government seemed very keen to go after alcohol and pubs in particular because it's where you'll have a conversation you might otherwise not have. It's rowdy, it's boisterous, it's social. Is part of the reason that there's so much interest amongst politicians in, say, cannabis legalisation, meanwhile they want to ban smoking, imply that they actually quite like people to be quite sedated. By contrast.
This is Hitchens' opinion. Mm. Yeah. He thinks there's a soma sort of element to this.
Isn't Christian Niemitz on this as well a little bit? I think there is, again, it's a bit like that kind of status thing, or how things are coded, I suppose, isn't it? Things, tobacco is coded as being right-wing, libertarian, old-fashioned, slightly grumpy, slightly stubborn, whereas tobacco is, it's a marijuana, man, yeah, like live and let live, and, you know, boundaries are diffuse, you know. Anything that goes against the first chapter and verse of the Gospel of John, basically. Anything that goes against logos and the breaking down of our ability to understand the world through putting it into language. There's a very strong, I mean, I find it quite fascinating the amount of popular music or popular art generally that is associated with certain drugs. And there's a certain point in your life when you go, oh, wow, man, the Beatles, they were all like high smoking marijuana. Most of the great music of the 60s was amphetamine fueled. Bob Dylan recorded the greatest single run of three albums in 18 months, basically never sleeping, just like absolutely fueled on speed and only using a little bit of grass to take the edge off once in a while. And if you're going to use it for that purpose, I think it's fine. But that's where you need productivity. Is what we need, right? That's the key.
Pushing the uppers.
Very useful.
I don't know whether Ozempic falls into that category. If there's one thing that's really, well, my wife tried it and she said that it sapped her energy, which, to be honest, to have an appetite repressant or depressant that, or suppressant, whatever it is, that also makes you feel tired, that's like the worst of both worlds, isn't it? Appetite suppressants are supposed to give you fizz. You know, you're better off literally just fasting.
Or take amphetamine.
Yeah,
people did used to take amphetamine.
Yeah, yeah.
I've come on a different podcast than one.
Well, I think it's no coincidence there's been a massive escalation in the amount of ADHD diagnosis, adult ADHD diagnosis, and pretty much every comedian is a little bit ADHD because you need to be distracted or make unexpected connections between things. That's how it works. But mainly the reason is because of the incentives that have been put in place. You pay 1,500 quid for a diagnosis and then you've got a lifetime's prescription speed, basically. All the Ritalin and Concerta and all these things that you can get in order to combat your ADHD are essentially just like keeping your dopamine fueled. People who are ADHD traditionally drink a lot of coffee and smoke cigarettes, you know, because they need that kind of sense of something constantly. They basically only burn kindling. They can't burn logs. And so they're just like...
Yeah. So unless Julia and Kate have got more views pro or anti on amphetamines, let's go out for some
no first-hand more... experience.
Any in the room, please let me know. Yes, gentlemen, there.
Hiya. Thomas Paul is always relevant, but just to quote him, not quite in full, but there is no such thing as solutions, only trade-offs, which means that... where are you coming from in terms of generating those trade-offs? What are you willing to trade off against what? So is maybe the road to hell is also, you know, by the cliche, is paved in good intentions. I'm not entirely even convinced that there are good intentions behind what Keir Starmer is doing in terms of his policy development. But it certainly is developing trade-offs. And also a system of perverse incentives, which is feeding back into those, you know, generating what is the outcome in actually on the street. So if we have a culturally impoverished cityscape devoid of pubs, where are people going to go then? What's going to happen? You know, just... play out the dystopian trade-offs with me, if you would.
We're going to be like in the Matrix. We're just going to be in a bubble where we're perfectly safe and we can't be harmed and we don't do anything wrong or say anything wrong. And we're just going to sit at home in our little bubbles. And I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but you start worrying that this is kind of how they think.
Absolutely, that's safetyism. So just, just lead off of anything with that. No. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. There was another question here in the middle. Yeah, can I pass it on to that just along there? Was there one down here as well? Yeah. And then could you also just give the mic to this gentleman whilst this person...
Yeah, you go. Pick a woman from the audience. There's not been a single woman.
I've been looking for them, but thank you very much for your assistance.
Wait, so if women want to say something, they'll say something. Yeah.
Right, so on the issue of availability and regulation of all these substances and addictions, I'm going to use an example of Iceland, where I think up until early 90s, alcohol was either banned or very unaffordable due to regulations. And then the rules changed. And then came a wave of alcoholism. So they basically, there was like one generation that really suffered from it until the society actually learned how to deal with it, having it available and deal with it in a mature way. So my question is, what is the better way of dealing with this? Is it to keep it unaffordable and just banned? Or is the right way to make it available and let the society develop mature ways of dealing with it, which, you know, at the cost of sacrificing a whole generation, potentially. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And, yep, down here.
Wouldn't bringing back fat shaming be cheaper and easier than fat jabs?
I want to grab one more if there's any still out there. If there's any women in the audience, you're really letting this gentleman down. So. And letting yourselves down. But if not, let's go to Laurie in the back.
Why didn't one of you just identify?
Yes, this beautiful young lady here. Please don't you.
Sorry, yeah. I am often... I do have a... Some people sometimes think that my name is a girl's name, but I get misgendered from time to time. So my question is, back on the pubs as a sort of social and cultural institution, we've seen, probably as a legacy of lockdown, this strange new phenomenon of people queuing in pubs and at bars, and I was just wondering what the panel thought of that.
Really good question. Chris?
Yeah, it's a real sign of decline, isn't it? The queuing in pubs. There's a Twitter feed that regularly shames people for queuing a single file in pubs. I think it's American tourists. I can't prove this, but I think it's probably American tourists. And
it
then
absolutely is.
Yeah. You get one person at the bar, and then an American tourist will stand behind, and then the British will go, oh, that's a queue, I better join it. And then, and then that's it. And the bar staff don't like it at all. So just break it. You won't get told off by the bar staff. You just break it. It takes some balls to do it sometimes, but we have to do it. Otherwise, we lose our culture.
It's true, because the tourist pubs, we both live down on the south coast. You know, the Devil's Dyke, the pub up on the on the south, there's often a queue there, and that's obviously a tourist pub, because it's like you get a view of Sussex from the top of the Dyke. Yeah. And I think that's right. I think, you've probably got foreign. Yeah, it's exactly how it starts. Some of you may have read a book about called Watching the English about 15, 20 years ago, Kate Fox. Yeah. I don't know if she was American or English. An anthropological study of, she's English, of how the British behave. And there's a fantastic, it's worth owning the book just for the chapter on pubs and all the little unwritten rules and codes which people adopt and learn through integration, through visiting at a young age and, you know, when you can absorb it. You break that for a year, for 18 months, and we all come back and we don't know how to behave. There's all kinds of, it's fine to fall into conversation with somebody at the bar, but as soon as you're sat down among your friends, it's not fine to just go over and join a group of people. And you laugh because it's so obvious, but I mean, a foreigner who never encountered this thing might very easily get that wrong. And that is the kind of thing that, you know, is, that's what culture is. That's why basically we rule the world and octopuses still struggle, because they are highly intelligent, but they do not have pumps.
That and the water thing.
Yeah.
Julia, fat shaming?
Bring well, because fat shaming. Mark. Oh, Ricky Gervais is quite big on this, isn't he? That when he was very overweight, he said, you know, I wanted to be fat shamed. I do think this is a very a relative of mine who talked about this the other day. They say, when you look at TV shows now and you see very, very, you know, morbidly, clinically obese people in the front row, and she said, you know, but 20 years ago, they wouldn't have been allowed in the TV audience. They'd be at the back. It would have been considered sort of too repulsive to have people. Nobody, if you look back at television, quite apart from the fact that people weren't overweight to the same extent. I mean, I'm of a generation where everyone in my class, you could see our ribs. You have one fat kid and the other 29 were all skinny. That was how people looked then. And, you know, you look back at any footage up to sort of 15, 20 years ago, that was the norm. So we have normalised it. And I think that is one of the biggest issues. And I certainly find it a really big issue among women, particularly younger women, is this body positivity thing about being body positive. I mean, yeah, I'm very glad you're happy with your life and your body, but you shouldn't be so positive about a body which will cause you to die 15 or 20 years earlier. I think that's a strange thing, and I think that we should not encourage that. And there's a lot of pop stars, the Lizzo, the women literally eating themselves to death
And then being positive about it. And we saw that with Adele when she lost weight, didn't we? And the amount of women who wanted to body shame her for losing weight and being a healthy weight. It's a very strange thing, and it's got very twisted.
There's some quite interesting footage you can see online of large high school gym and physical exercise regime installed by JFK in the 60s. It's extraordinary footage, lots of young boys and girls in America, like doing, you know, hand over hand on monkey bars and skinning up walls and things. And it looks extraordinarily like Germany in the 30s in my head. And I'm pro this kind of stuff. But somehow the idea of physical excellence...
I wanted to clarify that.
The idea of physical excellence, of expecting young people to be drilled in that kind of behaviour, has become coded as fascist. Mm-hmm. And that's a real danger. I don't know how that happened, but it is now seen. Articles in The Guardian kind of going, careful of going to the gym, because if you build up some muscle, you might find yourself drifting towards right-wing politics. Maybe there's some truth to it. I don't know. I think testosterone and a certain amount of certain political persuasions are possibly correlated, but you know, there's a real danger that is there for don't do it. You know, that's really, really worrying to me.
Kate, is there any questions you want to respond to? Are you queuing up in pubs as a natural reflex as an American?
Well, I'm nervous now with my nationality that perhaps I've been leading this queue charge accidentally.
I assume you just thought they were all drive through.
Take a little paper bag to go. To the question about Iceland and to expand it to other countries, you know, what is the right policy? Do you try to price people out of certain things? Do you let them have it for cheap? We have to address negative externalities, right? When there is something that may be environmental, that may be social, that is producing a negative externality, it is appropriate to tax it to some extent. And Chris will know much more about this than I do. But in the UK, we've gone far past that point. Smokers are paying three times over what they cost the NHS. Drinkers are paying far times over what they cost the NHS. So we've gone far past that point. But that's not to say that, you know, there shouldn't be a tax, something attached to it. It's just to say, how far do you actually want to take that? I think the question that interests me most was that one about trade-offs. Because Julia was joking, but you're completely correct. This idea that ideally they'll just put us in these little bubbles and nothing bad will ever happen and there's no trade-off. We had a real world experience of this not too long ago. It was called lockdown. And I was pro the first lockdown. I think we didn't know what that virus was. It was perfectly reasonable to lock down for some time. I was pro social distancing. I was pro the measures that scientifically worked, like meeting outdoors. But for 2 years, we had so many policies put into place that we knew very early on were not really helping to impact that virus. But they were keeping us apart, and they were keeping us so-called safe. So-called safe, not thinking about the thousands of children that have now dropped off the school register and we're not quite sure where they are, not thinking about the women in their 30s and 40s not getting their health checks and what's going to happen to them down the line. There's no public policy, as the gentleman said, without trade-offs. I worry post-lockdown because the public was given the impression that there is. The public was given the impression that the state can do everything, that the state can keep you safe, that the state can protect you from this global pandemic. And it is just simply not the case.
And that there's no cost.
And that there's
and
no cost whatsoever.
There's no money left.
No money, social cost, economic cost, all the rest of it. Everything has a trade-off attached. And politicians are so afraid to say it now. And things are going to break.
That's because they're complicit.
Yeah, well, they're complicit, but they're also terrified that if they say it out loud, they'll be punished at the ballot box. And they might be, but there needs to be a growing consensus. And maybe we're moving in the right direction on something like the National Health Service, right? At least we have a Labour Party that's willing to say this isn't actually very good. Hopefully now the Tories can follow, but this comes after decades of all politicians pretending that this thing was the envy of the world when the rest of the world looks at the NHS and goes, no, thank you, please. So, you know, maybe we're slightly moving in a better direction, but I deeply fear more things will break before politicians will really talk about trade-offs.
Can I give you some fun facts about Iceland?
Please.
They had prohibition in the 20s, and in the 30s they legalized wine because the Spanish refused to buy their fish unless they started buying their wine. And then some years later, they legalized spirits, but not beer, kind of weirdly, for a very odd reason. I mean, incredibly irrational reason. They said, well, you can drink a pint of beer a lot quicker than you drink a pint of whiskey. So we'll legalize the whiskey. They were thinking way too much about volume rather than strength. And do you know when they actually legalized beer? They want to guess? 1989. Wow. And they still, to this day, every year, have beer day where they celebrate the anniversary of being able to drink beer. But a pint of beer in Iceland, when I was there, it's probably gone up since, was at least £10 in a pub, at least £10. It's I mean, they're kind of rich anyway. But I was there in their so-called summer, where the temperature rose to the dizzy heights of 12 degrees one day. And it's genuinely light all day, which it's, you can see why they would become alcoholics, because it's either dark all the time, in which case you just want to drink, or you go, I tended to go to people's houses because it's so expensive to drink in the pub, but you'd be drinking there and you sort of, it's just light. It kind of gets darker, but never dark. And it feels like it's 8 p.m. and it's actually 2 in the morning. And you keep drinking. So there's nothing to tell you to stop drinking. And so you continue. So I can see why the government over the years has been very into the temperance stuff. It is quite hard to get the Scandis to stop drinking just because life is so cold and depressing. But that's basically the background with Iceland.
Excellent. A little bit of a history lesson there from Chris. We're fast running out of time, but before I let you all go and before I let your audience go as well. In this podcast, we always have a final question for our guests because we're very much a pro-freedom, anti-ban podcast. We invite our panellists to say if they had to have one ban, what would it be? And the only rules are that it can't be anything worthy. You can't ban.
Can't be anything too obvious that everyone would agree with, like too cyclists obvious. Or children. As
well. Yeah, exactly. Definitely children. We've had that too many times. But yeah, it can't be worthy. It can't be too obvious. Just, you know, dictator for a day, just something that really irks you. Kate, do you want to kick us off? If you had to have one ban, what would it be?
I hate the question, but it's a good one. It challenges us all. I'd ban slow walking. Mm. Oh, okay. We've my gosh. Authoritarian audience.
isn't that what Matt Lesh said last week?
It's quite popular.
Listeners, can you remember?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
I think it was.
It's clearly very popular.
Most of the choices are to do with people being annoying on the pavements of London.
Julia?
Yeah, mine is a general annoying behaviour on public transport, which I include slow walking, sniffing incessantly, just my head in, not understanding the concept of headphones and listening to music only you can hear, feet on seats, standing in front of the doors when the doors open so people can't get off, standing on the left on the escalators, walking up and then stopping near the top, all of these things. However, you said we're a solutions-based podcast, right? I have a solution. And I know this has also come up before, but I genuinely, when I say this, I'm not joking. I do need you to know, I'm not in favour of capital punishment. However, rapists, paedophiles, murderers, no. However, I'm thinking, just have about, I don't know, 10 or 20 people who are employed as snipers around the tube network. And you know how at a football match you can now text if someone's saying racist or homophobic abuse, you can say they're in, you know, row H, seat 23, and those stewards will come. I'm just saying, you can say, you know, third carriage, Northern Line, or the number 52 bus in Chester, or wherever it is, someone is doing this. And I'm just saying there'll be a number of snipers. Okay, it wouldn't be every single person, but there will be a risk, and that person would be summoned. And I'm just going for a flesh injury at first, but I think this could work. Come on, come with me, people. Come with me. Start a revolution.
It's alarmingly detailed. You've really thought a lot
about that. That's just the preface.
Simon.
Well, I was going to go with playing music on your phone, yes, on public transport. And I don't even know if that isn't banned already. But, of course, the serious question is not whether things be banned. It is whether we feel we have the confidence to intervene ourselves. Because we cannot, we don't want to, reinstate guards on every carriage. We need to just feel that if we speak up, the eight or other people in the carriage will have the confidence to get our backs, basically. Yeah. That's all that needs to happen. It's got to be a cultural shift. I don't know what would be. I'll tell you one. This is kind of in a way, it's like a reverse ban. But I would like to ban those armor-plated cashiers that seem to have emerged in all the local co-ops and Tesco Expresses recently. I live in Hove. I feel like I'm living in the fucking Bronx now. Every time I go to buy a loaf of bread, the guy is the other side of some huge inch-thick plexiglass. And this wasn't. This isn't a hangover from COVID. This is because they're afraid of theft. I would sooner they arm the cashiers, frankly, and bring back the level of humanise and stop tagging meat. You know, it's just so dystopian, for God's sake.
Some other popular picks. Chris, have you got a new one that you want to offer the audience? Wheelie suitcases is your favourite famous one, but is there any more that you want to add here?
Yeah. Elaborate coffee machines.
In any
context, particularly pubs. They shouldn't sell hot drinks in pubs at all. Even in coffee shops, they shouldn't sell expensive Italian. They just should have filter coffee, a big vat of it, and pour it out and give it to you because it's so. Sometimes when I get the train up to London or anywhere, I fancy getting a coffee. And I just run out of time because it takes so long for them to make this coffee for somebody. And I've only got 3 minutes. And eventually I just go, sorry, I've got to go because the train's coming. It's pointless. It's hard to justify charging £3.50 for a cup of coffee. If it was just coming out of a big metal, pot like it used to, they'd have to admit it's only really worth about £1. But yeah, I get rid of any kind of expensive coffee. It doesn't taste that much different. And all you want is a caffeine anyway, really.
Dave Gorman demonstrated a few years ago on one of his TV shows that also the introduction of like £10,000 worth of Gaggia coffee making equipment into a cafe eliminates the possibility of a kettle that can actually boil water so that you can get a decent cup of tea. Your coffee may be better, but then they try and make tea by putting a tea bag in the cup and then spraying it with steam.
And also those bloody Nespresso machines in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
I never know how to use them. And very often I will press the wrong button and it will just keep pumping water out into a cup that's too small for it. I don't understand them. Just give me a kettle and a little bag of Nescafe.
The modern world is troubling for you, isn't it?
It's only coffee.
Yeah, that sounds very difficult.
Not all of it. We've just gone backwards with coffee, I think.
If anyone would like to help Christopher afterwards with various
gadgets. I don't need any help. I've got my Kenko at home and a kettle, and that's all you need to make coffee.
On that very throwback note, could you join me in thanking our panel? Thanks very much, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day.